Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Delicious Magazine January podcast. This month, Rick Stein reveals what his disco days taught him about being a restaurateur. We find out why we need to eat ugly food to save the planet and get the best tips to get you through Blue Monday. We find a warm fire and a tempting welcome at Coombs Head Farm in Cornwall, and we discover what's in this month's edition of Delicious Magazine. But first to the tiny Cornish fishing port of Padstow to catch up with Rick Stein. He was performing at the town's annual food festival, which attracted more than 50,000 visitors, something I suggested was due to his reign as the king of Padstow. I asked him how that felt.
I have to put up with it, I suppose, but, you know, I'm not.
I mean, the only reason I say that is that people like Paul Ainsworth and Nathan Outlaw said yesterday when I was interviewing them that this would not happen. The Padstow Festival wouldn't happen if it hadn't been for you.
Well, that's really interesting, because I had a dinner at Paul's restaurant last night, and it's so good. And I was thinking, you know, we all need each other, really. You know, to have a restaurant of that prestige in Padstow means so much to us. But
that he can grow that kind of business now, as can Nathan, because Nathan came out of your kitchen for a start. But Padstow is a place where places like Paul Ainsworth's Padstow Town, House Number 6, they can all really flourish, largely because of the kind of the culture that has been created here, and that was by you. You can't get away with that.
Well, I think so, Gilly. I've always believed in this, and it's sort of developed over the years, that if you can sort of establish almost like a sort of base camp for sort of really good food, others can grow on it. And I remember years ago doing a TV series from Ludlow in Shropshire, and a friend of mine, Sean Hill, who's now moved on to Abergavenny,
to the stomping ground where I grew up,
really,
yeah.
To the walnut tree. But the same thing happened there. You need about two or three sort of like-minded people that believe in sort of excellence in food, and who also believe in cooperating with each other. Because in the old days, you know, there was always like, what's he doing then? Why has he got that on his menu, sort of thing? And now it's much more about, well, this is what we do, this is what Paul does, this is what Nathan does. And we all get on and understand the need to get on together and just sell the area. It's about, actually, Padstow. It's not about the individual restaurants.
Absolutely. And that affects the growers as well, and the producers, the fishermen. I mean, it's a really fantastic sort of self-feeding culture down here, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I mean, some of the fishermen I've been friends with since I opened the restaurant, you know, they're dropping a bit, you know, because that was in the mid-70s.
And I just bumped into one of those fishermen, his old mate, Johnny Mert.
You know, he's the real deal. He's a lobster fisherman, and so is all his family. I mean, I started buying from his grandfather years ago, you know, like in fact, my dad, Johnny Mert Sr. and my dad had a lobster boat together, you know, so I go back a long way with those Padstow fishermen.
And back in those old days, his famous seafood restaurant was home to a disco. And not just any old disco either.
Well, it was my disco, yeah. I opened it in 1974 with my best friend, Johnny Walter, as a disco, because I'd been running a mobile disco around the area. And I, fortunately, we had a bit of money. I had this uncle from Germany, great uncle, who left me 12 grand, which in the early 70s was like, you know,
huge amount.
Huge. And Johnny had some family money, so we bought what was a nightclub on the quayside in Padstow and turned it into a disco. But unfortunately, you know, we didn't really know how to run nightclubs. Still wouldn't, you know, it's very specialist. You have to have a lot of very large people and a good sense of humour and also a lot of physical ability, which me and Johnny didn't really have.
But there is that kind of sense of theatre that you must have had, that ability to create theatre.
That's a good question, because I've always thought that there is quite a lot of similarity between running a disco and running a restaurant. Basically, you're out to please people. You're out to sort of, you know, get them not thinking about their sort of problems, miseries, whatever, but thinking about what is so nice, either dancing to some really great music or eating some really great food.
So you've been doing telly, you've been doing all your big stuff for what, 25 years now?
Yeah.
What's ahead for you?
Well, I suppose what's ahead is just a feeling that of going on as long as they want me to. So I'm not sort of like thinking this is what I'd like to do next. It's you know, we've just done this series going through various European cities called Long Weekends. But next, I'm going to Mexico, because I've been to Mexico quite a few times and really wanted to do something quite, you know, for me, quite big for all Mexican cuisine, which I've always loved. So there's always something else to do. And because I do travel a lot, I do pick up ideas from all over the world about what I want to do. And I think it's, you know, I feel a bit like so reassured that David Attenborough is still, you know, enthusiastic into his late 80s, early 90s. You know, you just go on till you drop, really.
And here's Johnny and his uncle Bernard of Mert Shellfish landing their catch in the harbour. I asked Johnny if it had been a good day at sea.
Quite slow today. Yeah, I've been on my crab gear, so easterly wind kind of kills the fishing.
Bernard, how was it?
Very good.
Yeah? He said rather smugly.
But I know what I'm doing.
Supplying seafood for the likes of Rick Stein and Michelin-starred Padstow chefs Paul Ainsworth and Nathan Outlaw has meant that there are rich pickings for the Mert family. And Johnny thinks that as restaurants across the UK meet increasing demand for excellence, there's more than enough to go around.
What you'll find is there's some brilliant catch all around the country. You know, what we see in North Cornwall, Port Isaac boys and the Nuki boys, you know, we're all catching the same quality stuff. I think restaurants, certainly high-end restaurants, are really, really interested. And I think that if more fishermen were to contact them, say, the boys in the southeast that might be catching Dover soles, if they got directly in contact with some of these better high-end restaurants, you'd find that they would much rather work directly with fishermen. And that, even though you can't guarantee supply, I think restaurants, I think they like to have that little story behind the fishermen.
They do.
And it works, and their customers like it.
It's good work if you can get it, but it's not all plain sailing in the fishing industry. I asked Johnny if he would wish it for his own kids when they grow up.
Dad said if he sees them near the boats, he'll kick their ass over in the quay. So, but you don't know. You don't know what state things are going to be in 20 years. It's hard to know.
And that's the point, really, isn't it? What you're talking about is keeping a sustainable fishing industry. It looks pretty amazing around here. There's a lot of people who really want fish. Would you want it for your kids?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. Good. I think I would, but I don't know if their mum will let them.
Tim Wharton and Richard Horsey are the authors of Ugly Food, Overlooked and Undercooked, and are on a mission to change our buying habits. I took Tim to meet fishmonger Andrew Scott at Andrew's Fish Shop in the Open Market in Brighton. See what he's calling ugly.
I think a lot of UK fish buyers would look at this display and be quite off put by the fact, for example, that you've got so many whole fish.
I like giving them a choice. You know, there's nowhere else you can't go to Sainsbury's and buy a gurnard. Some people would look at that and they'd say, oh, that's a really ugly fish.
So pulling out those fins, it gives it a little bit of a character. It suddenly looks like a little Disney character.
It's beautiful.
Looking around Andrew's display of whole fish and shellfish, I asked them what they would take home and what they'd do with the cod cheeks I'd just spotted.
Well, I would just pan fry them with a bit of butter or in a bit of olive oil and a little bit of chopped garlic, chopped parsley until they're just cooked through. Delicious. I'm actually looking somewhat to the left of the cod cheeks. I'm looking at these, scad or horse mackerel, as it's sometimes called. If we were in Portugal, there wouldn't be any of those left, because that's the prized.
Yeah, and these are off the boat this morning. They're a beautiful fish. People don't like them because they don't look particularly good, but the flavour's gorgeous.
The Japanese are really, really fond of them.
People from the Med and North Africa, they will have them that size, and they'll skin them. They'll take the head off and they'll skin them, and then they flour them and fry them.
Huss, I think, is supremely underrated and available on the south coast. I mean, in Worthing, where I live, we still have day boat fishermen who actually sell from the beach. Yesterday, I bought half a dozen whiting smaller than that originally, but for about £1.20. Razor clams over there, which are becoming ever more fashionable.
And you just touched them and they came to life.
Yeah.
What would you do with them?
Griddle, put it on a griddle. You can steam them, but they're best done on a griddle and they open up.
I asked him why he'd chosen to focus in the book on octopus as his main example of ugly food.
It is my favourite food. I think you can prepare it in so many delicious ways. And it seems to be a nice kind of metaphor for everything we're talking about. I mean, octopuses are pretty ugly. I mean, you know, even if you kind of love them the way that I do, they're still pretty ugly. They're a very bizarre creature. You know, they've got an anus and a mouth, which is the same orifice. So they have detachable penises. And they're utterly delicious. They're incredibly thrifty, because you buy an octopus and you eat everything.
And actually, on a serious level, we do need to be much more diverse in our fish
Absolutely.
Eating, because from a sustainability issue, we're overfishing the seas.
Yes, and I mean, the one of the central things about a good aquaculture is that what we want to avoid catching is animals that live a long, 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 long time and grow relatively a small amount in that time. So, for example, some of the deep sea fish that have been marketed in recent years, you know, they live for 50 years and they grow to 2 kilos. Well, it's not going to take long to run out of those. Octopus live fast and die young. They're sustainable. I mean, there are some species of octopus that are being overfished in the Indian Ocean, for example, but over here in the UK, octopus stocks are going fine.
So give us your best octopus recipe.
Well, I think simple is best. My favourite octopus recipe is utterly simple. It's a freshly boiled octopus, warm, freshly boiled potatoes, warm. Cut the octopus arms up into sort of pieces about an inch long. Put the potatoes, warm, on a plate, strew with pieces of octopus, raw onion on top of that, and lashings of olive oil.
And is that a Portuguese recipe?
That's a Portuguese recipe, yeah. And a shout out to Senhor Armando Rocha, who showed me how to make it, and who I've only just reconnected with after 20 years on Facebook.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Delicious.
Hygge made big news before Christmas, with scores of books published on the scandy pursuit of cosiness. And there's been something of a backlash against it. Singer Johansson is the author of one of those books, How to Hygge, and tells us in the January issue of Delicious magazine how Nordic noir is not just for box sets. I joined her for a bowl of fresh, slowly simmered porridge to ask about that backlash and what hygge really means for the bleaker days of midwinter.
This is actually a classic Norwegian freezer jam, which is a compote that you make during the summer months with fresh fruit and berries. And all you do is just add sugar and ascorbic acid to the berries and stir it up and then freeze it. That's
it. And it's lovely because, you know, we only sort of eat seasonal stuff, don't we? But this is a kind of a little throwback to those light months.
Exactly.
Now, it's a couple of months after the book came out, mm-hmm. and we all know how to hygge now. Absolutely. It's all candles and cuddling up and being nice to the world outside. In the bleak months ahead, how can we hygge through the dark days? Give me a tip for Blue Monday, for example, the day when the credit cards all arrive after Christmas.
I'd say the best strategy from a Nordic perspective is to get outdoors. And there's now a lot of scientific research showing that you have a lot of psychological benefits from spending time outside in nature. Seeing different shades of green is very calming. It's very soothing to our eyes and very effective at reducing anxiety, and has also been shown to reduce some depressive symptoms as well. So there's only so much that's within our control. Obviously, if you've gone crazy spending lots of money at Christmas, then, well, you have my sympathies. But but I think
it felt good at the time.
It felt good at the time. And maybe for next year, think about reining in your spending.
I mean, for me, just reading through your book, it just really made me think that it's a philosophy that's about lighting up your life. And it's a metaphor, isn't it, for shining some light into the dark bits.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what people often forget is that in the frozen north, you know, although there's darkness, there's bleakness, you know, everyone's watched Nordic noir, you know what we're like as people. We're very melancholy. We can be quite dour, quite stern, and we're not prone to overuse of words. So there's that side of the Scandies and the Nordics, but actually there's also a lightness of touch, and we know this. There's a silver lining to everything that the Scandinavians have recognized that throughout the centuries. That it's one of the reasons why we go crazy during midsummer. We have so much fun, you know. We're healthy hedonists during the bright times of year, because we know that once we've survived winter, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You know, there's midsummer to look forward to. And you know, it's about having a sense of perspective, like everything, you know, knowing that the seasons change and we have to cope with that, you know, rather than fight it. And on the west coast of Norway, where my family's from, the locals in the local dialect, they still say, "Nu skal vi hygge oss," which means now we're going to have a good time. You know, that's the modern interpretation of hygge. But actually, historically, when you think about it, if you look at it from a linguistic point of view, hygge meant to be or to think. And so there's an element of, you know, this idea of it's a state of being, it's a state of mind, which is often forgotten in the kind of hygge hysteria about, you know, wrapping up with your cozy blankets and enjoying yourself. It's not gratuitous indulgence either. Scandinavians are not prone to that at all. We live very well and we live for the moment. And, you know, it's our Viking heritage. It's our pagan heritage, I think, more than anything. But actually, it's not a cozy surrender. You know, I think that's really been misinterpreted, this idea that it's giving up. You know, it's definitely not. We're born to be robust and to fight, you know, the elements. We don't just succumb to them.
Yeah. And actually, in terms of a robust approach to life on Blue Monday, perhaps to start off with this rather gorgeous porridge.
Aww.
Would be a really nice thing to do, wouldn't it? Because you've brought that strawberry back from a lighter time.
Exactly.
Tell me how you made the porridge.
Well, the porridge is it's made with sprouted oats from Rude Health, and they're really nutty and delicious. I'm not big on espousing the virtues of a healthy dish as such, but I think if it's naturally delicious, then go for it. And I really love these oats. So they're a bit more slow cooking, so they take a little bit longer to prepare. They took about 20 minutes to cook in total. So again, it's about that thing of stepping back and, you know, savoring something, whether that's cooking your porridge in the morning, sitting down and eating it rather than on the run or on the tube. And also making sure that, you know, you season it well. So there's vanilla salt in there from Hale & Mon. There's a bit of milk. But you could do anything. You could put other spices in. You could jazz up your porridge in a multitude of ways. But I've kept it quite simple. And then, of course, with the strawberry compote, a sort of soothing oaty flavor along with the bright jeweled color of the and flavor of the strawberries from the summer. It's kind of a match made in heaven, really.
Mmm, delicious.
Food writer, Instagrammer, and friend of Delicious Magazine podcast, Felicity Spector, has been embracing the winter by cozying up for the weekend at a food lover's dream of a B&B, Coombs Head Farm in Cornwall. She told me all about it.
Well, Coombs Head Farm was set up by the Pit Q chef, Tom Adams, and April Bloomfield, who is a British chef who works in New York. And they've set up this working farm, which is also a bed and breakfast, and does amazing dinners as well in the evening. And so I went down to try it out for a weekend. Wish I'd stayed two nights. It was so fantastic. It was just one of the most dreamy places. It was so relaxing. It was marvellous.
What kind of accommodation was it?
Well, it's not a luxury hotel, but it's just beautifully done up. It's a big farmhouse, and outside there's lots of grounds. They've got a working farm there, so it's not sort of pristine gardens or anything, but all the better for it, really, because you can see the chickens running around outside who lay the eggs for breakfast and all that kind of thing. And there are, I think, six bedrooms. One of them has a bunk bed for families with children. And it's just really comfortable, really sort of calming and relaxing.
Log fires and everything?
Oh, a big log fire, yeah. Lots of magazines lying around, lots of cookbooks. There's a whole cookbook corner devoted to Diana Henry, which I really like.
So it's the kind of place that a foodie would go for a lovely country retreat. But is there anything else that they do there?
Well, they are hoping to do, they may even have started them by now, some courses as well. So you could go down and spend an afternoon there learning bread making or something like that, and then stay for dinner in the evening. But it's the dinners which are really the main point. I mean, there's a big communal table, and it really takes, the dinner takes two parts. So you go in, there are sort of drinks. Tom is sort of cooking away, really sort of relaxedly in the kitchen. You wander around and chat to him while he's doing it. Lottie, who's his partner, is sort of passing around things. And he creates these really incredible sort of so-called snacks, which in anybody else's mind would be a sort of gourmet meal in themselves. Sort of these little tiny rye crackers filled with a sort of fennel puree and garlic capers, which I didn't even know were a thing. Lots of different pickles. He sort of whips up some kind of incredible taramasalata, and then the bread is just a meal in itself. He just kept drawing out these incredibly crusty loaves of sourdough, sliced them up. There were massive hunks of homemade butter with a very good ratio of sort of 1-to-1 bread to butter, which, you know, what's wrong with that? And all these things kept coming out. And then on the back of your mind, you're sort of tucking into this and thinking, there's a dinner to come, I mustn't overdo it.
And is it one of those long dinners that just goes on for 5 hours or so?
Yeah, and the wonderful thing is you just sit round a big communal table with all the other guests. You don't know who's going to be staying. So the weekend I went with a friend, there was a couple who'd come from Singapore who'd read about it somewhere and decided they really liked foodie things, and they'd managed to book it up. There was a lady who worked at the Jamie's 15 restaurant in Cornwall, and her friend who decided to meet up there and have a night there. There was a couple of Irish people who'd heard about it and were really into different food experiences. So yeah, it was a really interesting group of people.
And the next day, what did you get up to the next day?
Well, to be honest, we spent ages having breakfast, which is almost as good as dinner, because dinner was just a succession of wonderful courses. Tom's very into his pigs, obviously, but even though I don't eat pork, he'd made me some beautiful vegetarian alternatives, and it was all just stunning. And then for breakfast in the morning, we sat round the same table, and there was like endless coffee, homemade yogurt, homemade birch and muesli, stewed fruits, and then, of course, if you wanted to cook breakfast, massive slabs of pork belly and scrambled eggs. And all the sourdough bread came back again as toast. It was amazing. One of the couples had been staying for two nights, and that's when I wished I'd booked in another night, because it was so lovely. It would have been really nice to stay, because it's quite a long way, obviously, to go all the way to Cornwall. But we went for a really nice walk. They're happy to give you little maps of the area, but we went just down to the local village, had a little wander, tried not to get lost, and then had to go back for our train. But we could have stayed another day. There's plenty to do in the area. It's not near a beach or anything, but there's lots of lovely walks you could do. I think what Tom and Lottie want to do is create somewhere which is at the same time a working farm and a place for people to stay, with the focus on food. And they want somewhere where they eventually can rear all their own food and grow everything outside. They have to buy in some stuff. It's all from very, very good local producers. Tom's got these Mangalitsa pigs, which are his pride and glory. And you can see it happening somewhere where everything you see outside is going to end up on the plate, which is just a real privilege. And obviously the provenance will be, you know, pretty amazing.
And finally, I popped into the Delicious magazine office to chat to Deputy Editor Susan Lowe about her favourite features in the January issue.
We got lots of things. It being the new year, we wanted to do something that was going to be a little bit exciting and maybe not what every other magazine in the world was doing. So we're taking a very, very balanced approach.
And you don't do this new year, new you.
We don't do new year, new you. We have the idea that people should have a very balanced life and enjoy food and enjoy cooking and enjoy everything there is.
Delicious is all about giving you ideas to get the best out of the things that you love to do, basically cooking.
That's it in a nutshell. And we do like to indulge. We think it's good to indulge. And in January, when the weather is really cold, it's miserable out there, you feel better in your previous months in the year, January is the time to really sort of indulge yourself a bit, think about your health, think about your well-being, think about what you want to cook, think about spending time, think about doing it properly and having a great time in the kitchen, and have a balanced perspective on it. Don't get too crazy about beating yourself up over diets or, you know, what you can't do. Think about what you can do.
Yeah. You won't find a diet in Delicious magazine.
No, we don't do the D word. We do have very healthy recipes, though. So we always, always, always have information on how you can eat healthily.
But Nigella says, think about the first three letters in the word diet.
True, yeah. So one of the features we got this year is the launch of the Produce Awards 2017. The inaugural year was last year for the Produce Awards, and that was a huge success. And anyone who has any nominations, anyone that they think is a brilliant baker or a fisher person or anyone who makes or creates food that they think is fantastic, they can let us know via the website and nominate that person.
And we can hear the winners getting the news from Karen, the editor of Delicious, in the October podcast. So you can go to the iTunes and go back to that episode. What else have we got?
Another feature we've got is about action against hunger. And that's one of the charities that we support, and we're very happy to do so because it's a fantastic organisation. And this year there were three journalists, Bill Knott, Lisa Markwell and Dan Doherty, who went around the world and actually saw the work of Action Against Hunger in person and came back with some fantastic stories, which they tell in the issue, and also some fantastic recipes as well.
So from the next podcast, we're going to have members of the Delicious editorial team reading out readers' letters. What do they add to the magazine?
People write to us for all sorts of reasons. We all read them, we all talk about them, and if they need a response, we do respond to them. And then we choose the ones that we think are most indicative that month and put those into the issue. So many of them are congratulating us on the recipes, on the magazine, the look and the feel. And then sometimes people will have something to say that really sparks a conversation in the office. It gives us an idea of what to put in the magazine. It could spark a feature. It could spark something, a change, something that we do differently from then on. So they're really, really important. They're our lifeline, really, to our readers' thoughts.
And so if people do want to write in, they write readers@deliciousmagazine.co.uk. And that's it from the January edition of the Delicious Magazine podcast. Don't forget to rate and review it on iTunes. And if you'd like to hear it as soon as it goes live, you can subscribe for free on the podcast page of the Delicious website, deliciousmagazine.co.uk. And if you'd like to get in touch with any of your ideas, email readers@deliciousmagazine.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.